So our first presenter this afternoon is John Battenberg, presenting the Kamsari Language Community, Evaluating Language Vitality and Endangerment.
Okay, thank you. I would like to thank you for coming. I know the, right after lunch, Saturday before Sunday, so thank you for coming. Wanted to make a few comments about the Kamsari language community in Oman and the challenges with evaluating language vitality and endangerment. I've always had a little ambivalence about speaking about a particular minority language when I don't speak that particular language. And I published a bit on Berber, and I had a Berber colleague who was a linguist, and he said, John, don't worry about it. He said, when we write about Berber, our motives are suspect. When you write about Berber, your motives are not suspect, so relax. So I thought that was good. Anyhow, I'm not gonna talk about the structure of Kamsari. I'm gonna be talking about the language community and then efforts, or how do we evaluate vitality and assessment. The Arabian Peninsula has few surviving language minority communities. As in other Arab countries, modern standard Arabic is used in formal context, and other varieties of Arabic are employed in less formal situations. English, of course, is the dominant foreign language within education and other sectors of society. And because of the large number of expatriates working in the Persian Gulf, obviously you have languages representing South and Southeast Asia, Europe, and Iran. This paper considers the status of the Kamsari language community. Peterson has observed ethnic boundaries in Oman are not generally divided by territory, occupation, or even class, but rather by language, or sect, or both. Research about Kamsari, an Iranian language spoken by about 3,000 speakers, provides insights, I believe, into language minority communities within the Arab world. Kamsaris live in the Musandam Governorate, a northern enclave of Oman, separated from the rest of the country by 30 miles of the UAE. It also borders the UAE and the Strait of Hormuz. What's interesting about Kamsari and Musandam is it's only 35 miles from the coast of Iran. There's been very little research about the Kamsari language community, probably because of its small number of speakers, and they live in relative isolation. In a 2006 article on Iranian languages in the Encyclopedia of Languages and Linguistics, the author, Skarov, has observed, it is unknown whether this language is even spoken today. I'm happy to tell you the language is spoken. It is an Iranian language with significant Arabic influence, and it continues to be used in the Musandam Peninsula, although its survival is certainly at risk. In a chapter entitled Language Shift and Language Revitalization, Nancy Hornberger, in 2010, surveyed research projects on language maintenance in various parts of the world. And she said there is particular need to pay attention to language minority communities in the Arab world. This study of Kamsari speakers is intended to contribute to the small body of research on language minority communities in the Arab world. Reversing language shift is seen by many researchers, and I don't need to tell you this, as a daunting activity. Fishman in 2001 surveyed about a dozen case studies that he was involved in the 1980s and 1990s. And he writes that when he looked at threatened languages, none of the reversing language shift projects can be characterized as dramatic successes. Fishman says reversing language shift is concerned with the recovery, recreating and retaining a complete way of life, including both linguistic and non-linguistic features. Susan Romaine writes that the loss of linguistic diversity is something that we talk about, but we understand more about how diversity is lost than how it is maintained. In 1999, I published an article on the gradual death of the Berber language in Tunisia. The present study of Kamsari speakers is not meant to be comparative with this earlier study. However, once again, the goal is to better understand a language minority community surrounded predominantly by Arabic speakers. There are significant differences, of course, between these communities. The population of Berber speakers in the south of Tunisia was estimated to be between 40 and 60,000 in the mid-1990s. The number of Kamsari speakers is estimated to be about 3,000. In Tunisia and other countries in the Maghreb, Berber speakers have often encountered discrimination and been thought to pose a political threat by the government. Although such treatment and perceptions still continues, I believe it has decreased to a certain extent. When you look at Kamsari in Oman, they're not oppressed by the government. They're not mistreated by the government. For the most part, they're neglected by the government. The Berber community in Tunisia and the Kamsari community in Oman, of course, share certain characteristics. Speakers of both languages use varieties of Arabic, and each minority language is only spoken among friends, families, and coworkers. Neither Berber in Tunisia nor Kamsari is written or used in education, speeches, conferences, religion, or mass media. Furthermore, both communities are located in geographically isolated regions that are gradually opening up to the outside world. When we talk about at-risk languages or dying languages, we often lack a specific terminology to talk about the loss of language within a community. Harrison has pointed out we use metaphors: language death, language shift, threatened languages, extinct languages, last words, or vanishing voices. Grenoble and Whaley have also acknowledged labels such as minority language, heritage language, mother tongue, dominated language, threatened language, or endangered language, even though they recommend the term local language. Again, I think what Fishman says is interesting. What the smaller and weaker languages and peoples and cultures of the world need are not generalized predictions of dire and even terminal illness, but rather the development of therapeutic understandings and approaches that can be adjusted so as to tackle the essentially the same illness in patient after patient. Although many have argued for a more systematic approach to describing language minority communities, designing and agreeing on a typology has been very challenging and may in fact be impossible due to a wide range of factors pertaining to small language communities. I have a couple pictures of Berber communities in the south of Tunisia. Again, they live in isolation. There's really only six villages, and they are declining. Kamsari in Oman is interesting because, again, if you look at the map, you're only talking about, again, this small section north of the UAE in Oman, and there are only several towns where you have a significant number of Kamsari speakers. Kasab is one. Kamsar is another. In order to go to Kamsar, you need special permission from the government, which I received, and you can only go in by boat or by helicopter. There are no roads, which is interesting. Early mention of the Musandam Peninsula occurs as early as 1866 in William Palgrave's book, Narrative of a Year, Journal Through Central and Eastern Arabia. Palgrave was an Arabic scholar, and he recounts these experiences sailing along the coast, meeting fishermen and shepherds in local villages. And he gives us a depiction of the language spoken aboard ships sailing through the Strait of Hormuz. And what is interesting is there are many similarities between his depiction of this language and Kamsari. Bertrand Thomas wrote a monograph on Kamsari. Thomas, in 1930. Thomas was a British civil servant working in Oman. He was the first Westerner to cross the empty quarter. And Thomas writes a book called Arabia Felix in 1932, where he provides a detailed description of Bedouin tribal customs. Arabia Felix, of course, was the Latin phrase used by the Romans to mean fortunate desert. Long before the discovery of oil, it was believed that this magical and ancient region was the original home of Queen of Sheba, and that there were immense riches found there. The Musandam Peninsula lies north of the empty quarter, and it is here that Thomas describes Kamsari speakers. Although he was not trained in linguistics, many of Thomas's observations remain quite interesting. Thomas collected 553 Kamsari words from, quote, the lips of its illiterate exponents. Thomas writes, Kamsari is largely a compound of Arabic and Persian, but it is distinct from them both. In his analysis of Kamsari vocabulary, Thomas found more Persian than Arabic roots, and he comments on the phonology and grammatical structure of the language. He concludes his study by stating Kamsari is quite an Iranian dialect. Both geographically and linguistically, they point to consideration from the opposite side of the Persian Gulf. Residents of Musandam continued to depend on the sea passages of the Persian Gulf. Historically, pearls came from the ocean. Today, still, fish come from the Strait of Hormuz, and shipping lanes for transporting products are still important. At various times, Musandam was fought over by the Persians, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the British, while the interior regions of the Gulf were often neglected by foreign powers. The coastline posed considerable political and economic interest. Certainly in 1970 is when you have the formation of the modern state of Oman, so it's quite recent. These historic events, I think, are important because Kamsari has an influence not only of Persian and Arabic in its lexicon, but also Portuguese, Hindi, and English. Although the structure of Kamsari is based on the southwestern Iranian language known as Lori, it has been affected by contact with many other languages. The geographic location of the Kamsari language community continues to be of extreme importance. Sir Arnold Wilson in 1928 wrote about this inland sea between the Arabian Peninsula and Iran. And he says, "No arm of the sea is of greater interest to the geologist, the archaeologist, the historian, the geographer, I would add the linguist also." He says the Gulf has a place in the written history of mankind older than that of any other inland sea. At present, 20% of all oil, or 40% of the world's seaborne oil shipments, pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Although those who live in Musandam do not generally participate in the shipping of oil, they continue to use the waterway primarily for fishing and transporting goods. And one of the ways that goods are transported is with smugglers. So if you go to the Musandam Peninsula today, you will see smugglers in fiberglass boats with large outboard motors. They go to Iran, and in Iran they deposit consumer electronics and cigarettes. On the Omani side, they bring in livestock for sale in the UAE and Saudi Arabia. Up to 500 boats a day make this trip, this 45-minute trip in violation of international sanctions. The smuggling is an important part of the Iranian and the Omani economy. It's also a good example of contact between both sides of the Straits of Hormuz. In the port of Kassab, over half of the Musandam economy is estimated to be dependent on such trade. One young Omani male claims that unfortunately he has been unsuccessful in securing a government job. But he says, smuggling is sort of like a government job, but with goats. Contact between traders and sailors speaking a variety of languages along the Strait of Hormuz was largely responsible for the emergence of the Kamsari language. However, the increased contact with other languages and cultures today threaten this community. Research by Christina van der Waal Enenby, for example, indicates that intense contact with Arabic has only taken place within the last two generations and has been largely due to the introduction of education and television. Various classifications have been proposed to assess the vitality of language communities. You have the UNESCO document that came out in 2003 that considers nine factors: intergenerational transmission, absolute number of speakers, proportional speakers, trends in domains, response in domains in media, material, government and institutional language attitudes and policy, community member attitudes, and amount of quality of documentation. Two recent models for evaluating language vitality include Flory's 2009 Language Vitality Test and Harmon and Lowe's Index of Linguistic Diversity. Flory's test attempts to assess receptive, productive, and creative language proficiencies. And Harmon and Lowe's Index measures the rate of change in linguistic diversity since 1970 by determining how far, on average, the language in a given grouping deviate from a hypothetical situation in which each language is neither increasing nor decreasing its share of the total population. This quantitative model attempting to better measure language demographic data is, of course, just a snapshot and does not account for the complexities of language decline or loss within a community. At-risk languages must be considered within a continuum. As the authors of the UNESCO study acknowledge, a language that is ranked highly according to one criterion may deserve immediate and urgent attention due to other factors. To illustrate, Dwyer argues that certain factors are more important: intergenerational transmission, proportion of the speakers within the total population, and language domains. With the Kamsari population, for example, the degree of intergenerational transmission is very high. Another challenge may be that many members of these language communities in the Arab world resist considering their language as a real language deserving recognition. Nancy Dorian has observed, it requires enormous social and psychological self-confidence for any small group to insist on the importance of ancestral language retention. Grenoble and Whaley have proposed a six-tier model to categorize language endangerment: safe, at risk, disappearing, moribund, nearly extinct, and extinct. Berber in Tunisia and Kamsari in Oman are certainly at risk because even without significant reduction in the number of speakers, they are used in few domains and lack the necessary safeguards for language maintenance. In the past several decades, positions held by various scholars on language endangerment are quite well documented. On the one side is a minority who see language loss as a regrettable yet natural and normal phenomenon. It is argued that new languages and cultures emerge as others are lost. On the other side are a majority of researchers who view the loss of language as, quote, part of the more general loss being suffered by the world, the loss of diversity in all things. And I think most of the people, if not all, at this conference would share that viewpoint. Whether language is viewed as a symbolic system having specific linguistic features used for communication, or it is considered as a resource that can be used, nurtured, or neglected by individuals or communities, it is clear that these language minority communities in the Arab world face an uncertain future. I think particularly with the Arab Spring, we see that. I think it's pretty clear that when you look at language minority communities, not only Kamsari, not only Berber, but if you look at Coptic, another example, and Aramaic is a fourth example, and their future is certainly at risk. I hope my comments here today stimulate discussion and interest about neglected Arab language communities in the Arab world. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond, or if you have any comments. Thank you.
Wild question for you.
All right, I'll try to give a wild answer.
Okay. No, I was wondering how conservative this language might be, and would there, among the other languages that have influenced, could you find Austronesian traces? Because the Austronesians left Borneo a couple thousand years ago and made their way to Malagasy, or to Madagascar.
Right.
And I think the most likely case is that they coasted, and that might be an interesting stopping place for them.
Right.
Well, if the language is really conservative, they may have some Austronesian influence.
Could be. I mean, a lot of the, as I say, the focus has been on A, establishing its Iranian language, B, looking at quite a bit of lexical borrowing from Arabic, and then the examples that are often looked at are, again, with Hindi. Portuguese is very interesting in terms of what's going on in India at the time, and then English also. It is interesting if you go today, again with the 3,000 speakers, high rate of intergenerational transmission. So if you talk with them, they'll say, no, we're doing fine, there's no problem, right? Yet at the same time, obviously, it used to be, as with Berbers in Tunisia, you had extreme isolation, okay? And now you have the world coming to them for a whole variety of reasons. Which I think can compromise the language. I think it's interesting that, again, the government of Oman seems pretty indifferent. It's not that they're persecuting them. It's very, even though the numbers are much larger in Tunisia, the attitude, I think, of the government is quite different. Syria was interesting because when you look at Armenia, when you look at Aramaic, thank you. The Syrian government, obviously, and there are political reasons why they were doing that, were actually supporting and actually financed an institute in some of those small villages, Mulula and some of the others outside of Damascus. So again, we can question maybe their motives, but they were actually not only paying lip service, but you know, putting some money into trying to record and teach the language. So again, I think it'd be very interesting to see after the Arab Spring, or what many of us call the Arab Winter, passes, what will happen. But I think in certain cases it will not be positive for some of these language minority groups. Yes?
Have you examined the different sets of loan words and to what domains that they refer to? Like this Portuguese
right.
loans, do they mostly refer to like trading or shipping or anything?
Right. I haven't yeah. really. I mean, I was in the UAE from 2010 to 2013, mm-hmm. and because I had done some work on Berber before, I was looking more at the language community per se and trying to look at the context.
Okay.
Again, here we have a researcher in 2006 who says, we don't even know if the language exists, right? And it does exist, but the numbers are quite small. I think another area of interest, and there has been some research of looking at variety spoken on the other side of the Strait of Hormuz, and there are extreme similarities with linguistic variety spoken on the other side, which is sort of interesting.
Is anyone working on that?
Yes. Well, there was one monograph out about the small island on the Iranian side. I think part of the issue is, again, mobility is getting into these countries, and it, you know, if you show up and say, you know, I'm a linguist, I'm sort of, you know, it's interesting, the Arab world, there are not surveys, there's not census data about language, because it can be extremely explosive. So most of the time, you have to do a bit of homework, and then ask questions about, you know, how much do you want to sort of, you know, ask for permission or ask for forgiveness, one of the two. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
For Kumzari, given that the generational transmission is satisfactory, but on the other hand, the domains of language are very limited.
Yes.
How would you scale the level of endangerment of Kumzari?
Right. I don't have an actual number, but I think ironically, in some way. Even though you have 3,000 with Kamsari and 40 to 60,000 in Tunisia, in some way I think Kamsari may be a little not great. All right, part of it is with Berbers. Many times they immigrate to larger cities or they immigrate to places like France. Kamsaris don't do that, so I think that is interesting. I think one of the issues, obviously, is there's not a realization within the Kamsari community that they possess something, their language, that is of interest, that needs to be studied, that needs to be recorded. That, frankly, is a foreign concept. I wonder also, at various times, when the political situation is heated up along, I'll tell you right, National Geographic did an article on Kamsari last January, and they called me up. And said, well, we want to talk to you about the Kamsari language. I said, fine, I'll tell you what I know about the context of Kamsari speakers and all that. Well, the article came out in January. It was an article on rock climbing in Musandam. And there was one paragraph on certain linguists believe X, Y, and Z. It was actually more like two sentences. So I thought, here is the chance to get the word out about the Kamsari language. It didn't happen. Right? But one does wonder if, and I hope it doesn't, but the political situation were explosive. Obviously, that is a strategic area for the shipping of oil. Yes, it's been neglected. Maybe in some ways, it would be better if it continues to be neglected. I mean, it's very interesting when you look at language minority communities, and many times what we think of as good, roads, television, running water, electricity, literacy in another language obviously can, you know, be harmful to certain communities and their language. Yes, there was a hand.
Yeah, so two questions. One thing I don't see in any of the descriptions of vitality is like how does socioeconomic situations, how endangering is a change in socioeconomic changes, right? So here we have a case, if sanctions, international sanctions were lifted from Iran, exports, the export business of these people would fall flat on its face, right?
Yes.
So,
or at least would be decreased, I think, significantly.
Yeah, yeah. So the economic interests then have, but I don't see where that type of issue
right.
fits on these kind of scales.
Yeah.
And second, I don't see fishermen's gifts on in your.
Yeah, and I had that, but due to the interest of time, I.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I think you are. Correct. I mean, I think in some ways these international sanctions actually provide opportunities for continued contact on both sides of the Strait of Hormuz. It's very interesting to see if, let's, you know, the sanction is a soft sanction. I mean, you
sure.
go to Iran today, and I've been to Iran recently, and you'll see brand new red Mercedes or Mustangs driving in, a lot of them, but you'll see some, and you're thinking, isn't there supposed to be some sanctions? You know? So it does seem to be a sort of a soft sanction, but I think a very interesting question about what happens linguistically. How are we doing with time?
Got a couple more minutes.
Couple more
yeah.
minutes. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much.